Welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Kaveh Movahed. It's my first time on this side of the control room window for LTNM. I'm happy to be with you. The 2021 New Mexico legislative session began this week with in-person meetings on Monday, followed by a switch to a virtual session where legislators will meet online, working from home like many of us have to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Many legislators have been meeting this way in interim committees for months now, and aside from a few technical challenges, it's gone fairly smoothly. But the annual session, usually held in the Capitol Building in Santa Fe, is a place where citizens and interest groups are able to speak publicly or often get meetings with legislators who represent them. We'll take a look at how that's different this year. Then we'll check in on the state's budget after a predicted major shortfall has recently changed to a less lethal deficit. Finally, we'll hear from people in the know on a few of the most important topics the legislature will address in the coming weeks. It's a lot to tackle in an hour, and we have several guests joining us, so we'll move quickly. But we want to hear from you also. Do you think lawmakers should be more concerned about kids missing out on school? Maybe you want less talk and more action on the environment, or you think government can do more to help us stay healthy. Email us at letstalk@kunm.org or call in live at 277-5866. My first guest is David Abbey, director of the Legislative Finance Committee. The LFC is tasked with analyzing fiscal and public policy and evaluating program performance for legislators. Good morning, Mr. Abbey. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Kaveh.
All right. Let's start with the scene at the online session this year. What's that experience been like for you so far?
Well, it's challenging. The staff of the Legislative Committee have been coming to the Capitol regularly, daily, for almost the onset of the epidemic. So, but now we have more people here, but compared to a regular session, it's still very empty. We work a lot with the House Appropriations Finance Committee. They're the one committee that is going to try to have what I'll call hybrid meetings with members here in a presence, although some members may be virtual and testimony will be virtual. So part of that is just a sense that in order to work on budget development, there needs to be one-on-one communication in person.
Okay, so we're only a few days into the session. I wonder if you've seen whether the public has the access to lawmakers that we're used to from, you know, previous years.
Well, it's not what we're used to, and it's by any measure a challenge. The public, the lobbyists, the press has access to the building, and they have attended the meetings that have been held in the Capitol in person. But if you look at committee's agendas, there are instructions in effect for how to provide input, whether by email or another way, and I think that's still a work in progress to make that effective. HAFC kicked off a first hearing on Tuesday, and it, from their procedural point of view, it worked, but the audio is apparently shaky for the public, and I know today they have plans to make it better, but it'll be a work in progress.
Okay, I wonder if then beyond just the public being able to observe, have you seen so far any kind of actual input from the public?
Pretty limited so far.
Yeah, okay. Well, all right, let's go ahead and pivot and talk a little bit about budget. There were predictions last spring that the government might be in dire straits because of the pandemic, but now that seems to have changed. Can you kind of explain where we were fiscally and then what happened?
Yeah. Well, we went into the special session in June with a known collapse of the oil and gas economy in our state. Drilling went from 118 rigs to about 40. Prices were $20 at the time of the special session, well, in May anyway, just before the special session. $20 a barrel. We'd been used to 50s prices in the 50s. So, and then the economy lost perhaps 100,000 jobs, about 8 to 10% increase in unemployment. And consequently, there was a projection that that would continue into the current into FY22, the current fiscal year. 21 is the current year, and into next year. Well, it turns out that the stimulus passed by the federal government, the CARES Act, in the spring, turned out to be much more effective in halting the downturn of the economy. And then we have another round of stimulus even in December that passed, $900 billion, of which hundreds of millions will come to New Mexico. And that also is going to contribute probably to a faster rebound. So now we see oil production recovering, oil prices, and actually $53 per barrel this morning. We're probably getting $49 in New Mexico. So, and we've regained about half the jobs that were lost at the depth in say, May. So okay, a faster recovery.
There are a bunch of factors then. We have oil prices recovering. We have the special session where legislators kind of cut back a little bit on spending. Jobs are coming back. So it's a bunch of things working together.
Yes, and federal revenue is still pouring in.
Right.
And also oil production recovering, not just prices.
Okay. So the LFC creates a budget proposal every year, just like the governor does. And this time, both budgets have kind of a similar bottom line, around $7.3 billion. Are there some differences between the two proposals you can highlight for listeners?
Yes. The dollar difference is the governor recommended about $60 million less than the LFC. They didn't use all the available revenue. But the biggest difference is Medicaid. The executive budget is about $70 million lower than the LFC recommendation for Medicaid. And even we were concerned that the LFC recommendation might be somewhat below the forecast. That Medicaid budget is complicated because we have an enhanced match of federal funds worth about 6%. Continuing all the way through this year. We don't know into next year. So that's an uncertainty. Enrollment has grown about 10%. So that's a big difference.
Okay.
The other big one is that the LFC has a modest, what we would call a cost of living adjustment of 1.5% at a cost of about $60 million. The adjustments in pay for public employees is only 1.5%. Has only happened six times in the last 12 years. We worry about falling behind in competitiveness and recruitment and retention. So there is that modest cost of living adjustment of $60 million that the executive doesn't have for 1.5%. Those are the biggest differences there. The executive probably has modest expansions for many agencies. But in general, there's a confidence among members that they can work out these differences with the governor and concerning the executive agencies. There are also differences, not so much in the bottom line, but the ways the funds flow for both public schools and higher ed.
Okay, thank you. Now, we were just talking about the rebound in oil prices. We have a caller, Bill from Los Lunas, who has something he'd like to say. Bill, are you with us?
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Your prices on $20 a barrel, $40 a barrel, that's what the manufacturers of oil and gas are pushing. But they're not saying what you're getting in the shelves. A quart of oil in the shelves at the store is average around $5 a barrel. Some go as high as $8 a barrel, a quart. Now you add 4 quarts to a gallon, 55 gallons to a barrel, and you wind up with $1,500 a barrel is what they're making in the shelves. Does the governor know that? Does the finance company know that? I don't think so. We also have a monopoly in Albuquerque of businesses that the governor and the city has to figure out.
Okay, Bill. I guess maybe we should point out that there is a difference between crude oil prices and oil in quarts on the shelves in auto parts stores and so forth, not just the processing and refining and distribution and packaging and all of that. But, does he have a point? What do you think, Mr. Abbey?
Well, you answered. I think your comment is pertinent. There's economies of scale in crude oil production. It's very different than selling highly refined product, quarter a pint at the time at the auto parts store. And I think that accounts for the differences. So good response.
Okay, thank you. Well, finally then, when looking to the future, what recommendations do you have for legislators when it comes to maintaining a healthy fiscal standing?
Well, that's a really good question. There's a lot of conversation about what reserve level to have. And it used to be the thinking that was 5% would be enough. And as we've gone increasingly aware that oil and gas is dominating state revenues, we think at least 30%, sometimes as much as 40% of state revenues directly come from oil and gas. And when it's so volatile, you know, when we can go from 55 to 20 in a month, it commends the state to have a higher reserve level. So it served us well to have 25% coming out of the regular session last year. I think with prices lower, perhaps a little less lower downside risk, the LFC recommendation was 22%. But still, volatility drives the need to have a healthy state reserve level.
Okay, thank you so much for being with us this morning, Mr. Abbey. We are going to move on now that we've talked to numbers and start talking some issues. I have a question for the listeners. Have you ever attended the legislative session? Will you be doing so now that it's online? If the format makes a difference to you, let us know why. Call 277-5866 or tweet to us with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. Our next guest is Democratic State Representative Gregorio Andres Romero. He is the chair of the House Education Committee. Thank you so very much for joining us this morning. Andres, are you there?
Good morning. Good morning, I am. Good morning, Kaveh. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for being here. I know education's a big topic, but I'd like you to run us through some of the legislation we'll see this year. And maybe you can start with House Bill 83. That's your bill to change high school graduation requirements. Tell us a little bit about the proposed changes and why it's important.
Sure. House Bill 83 is aimed at really modernizing and being more inclusive of different sorts of classes for students to achieve their high school diploma. So it's changing the requirements for 9th to 12th graders, really at modernizing some of the credits and class possibilities that students can take during their high school years. And we've had the statute for a number of years now, and it's pretty outdated. And so we're really looking at modernizing it, being more inclusive of the sciences, being more inclusive of career technical education and high school civics, as we know, has become vitally important for our students, especially now.
Okay, and I think I'll point out that beyond being the chair of the Education Committee, you are also a public school teacher, so you have intimate knowledge with this stuff.
No, definitely. I teach 11th grade U.S. history at Atrisco Heritage Academy High School here in the South Valley. So definitely. I mean, I bounce this idea around with my students and talk to them, and a number of teachers have had a lot of input on these requirements. So it's something that's been worked on and pretty well thought out, and then we'll put it through the process and see what the membership really thinks, because I think certainly in house education, we have such a diverse set of members with a lot of different and varying experience in education that'll definitely be helpful in talking out these issues that are going to, I think, really, really make an impact for high school students across the state.
So I guess I wonder, from your classroom experience, do you think the kids just aren't getting enough of those science and civics courses, or you just want to kind of have rules in place to encourage them to do more?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think it's important that students have options, options that lead or further enhance their interest in a particular career field, that they have the opportunity to really incorporate math and sciences, for example, into practical jobs or job possibilities, and to really get them interested and engaged in what they're studying, because, you know, you're able to get a lot more students more interested in the classes they take if they're taking something that they're truly interested or passionate in. And I think that's really the part of the driving force behind House Bill 83.
Okay, thanks. I know you're also thinking about school calendar reform. The K-5 Plus and extended learning time programs are available to schools that want to add days to the school year, and they come with the benefit of extra funding. But you don't think more days in school are the only answer, right? Tell us about those programs and your ideas.
Right. So A couple years ago, the legislature kind of passed House Bill 5, Senate Bill 1, and have programs in statute that's K-5 plus, adding 25 days for elementary students, or extended learning, which is adding 10 days to the calendar for students. Now these have been well thought out and well funded programs, and part of what we're seeing from school districts is really a want for more flexibility in what that sort of calendar reform may be. So I think adding an option such as extending the school day may be another possibility in terms of calendar reform, to give teachers time during the school day in order to lesson plan or have professional development or collaborate with one another. It would also give time for schools to really implement any sort of enhanced learning opportunity that the studies show that are vitally needed in our schools and lead to greater educational outcome and interest for students. So I think enrichment opportunities and that enhanced professional development within the school day for educators is something that districts really are looking for.
Sorry to cut you off here, but we need to take a quick break. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Kaveh Movahed. We'll be right back.
This Week in This American Life, maybe you've seen the video online of the white police officer taking selfies with one of the rioters who was storming the Capitol. Elsewhere in the Capitol, black police officers were having a very different experience, fending off physical attacks, racist threats. What that was like this week.
Sundays at 4 on KUNM.
The Rothstein Donatelli Law Firm is committed to supporting KUNM, where the law firm's criminal practice can help clients petition state courts to permanently remove public records related to criminal charges and certain convictions. RothsteinLaw.com.
All right, welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Kaveh Movahed. We're taking your calls about the issues legislators will tackle this session. What's most important to you? Give us a call at 277-5866 and let us know. All right, those programs we were just talking about with Democratic State Representative Gregorio Andres Romero, the K-5 Plus and Extended Learning Time programs are on hold for now because in-person school isn't happening for the most part. How worried should New Mexican parents be about pandemic-related learning loss?
And I think that's something that we're really going to have to address as educators and school districts when we start having a safe environment for students to come back. There are initiatives to really try to the students that are not attending class to really start working on what's happening to them, check up on them, make sure that their needs are being met at this time. But I think that's a big lingering question mark that teachers, that districts are really going to have to answer when students start coming back. And it's going to vary in a lot of different ways because of the pandemic. So I think it's important for us as a state to provide the resources for school districts in order to, begin assessing their students, both for their physical, mental well-being, but as well as for their educational needs as well. And I think that's what the role of the state needs to be, is providing those resources to the districts to ensure that they have plenty to work with students in all those different areas.
Okay, great. Finally, whether classes are in person or online, there are concerns about funds being distributed among districts fairly. That's especially true for New Mexico's tribal communities. How can we improve that situation?
That's a good question. So there are a number of initiatives now in order to really look at how funds are distributed across the state. I mean, we're under a sufficiency lawsuit where not enough funds are going to districts and meeting the needs of students that the state is really working hard to address and continue working. And I think that's really important. I mean, there's an issue around federal impact aid for districts within tribal lands. That'll be an issue coming up. Director Abbey, in each of the budget proposals, has money in order to work on that issue, and it's definitely an equity question. And then looking at the state equalization guarantee, how we fund schools in general to ensure that the needs of students are being met, whether they're in a rural school district or whether they're in an urban school district, and how the complexion of these school districts may vary and what the needs are, and are those being addressed or not. So those are big questions that this legislative session we're going to be tackling and continue to look at. I mean, it's something that every year needs constant review to make sure that we're doing enough and enough of these resources are getting out there to all of New Mexico students and district.
Okay, thank you. I hope we can have another show in the future and dedicate an hour to talking about education, because I think it deserves it. Thank you for joining us. That is Democratic State Representative Gregorio Andres Romero. He's chair of the House Education Committee. Thanks for being with us.
Have a good day.
All right. We have an email from Tom Guralnik from Albuquerque. He's the founder and director of the Outpost Performance Space. He'd like to urge legislators to think about the role of arts and culture in our society. He says we should remember the role that arts and culture play in the healing and strength of our society, and how it also feeds into issues like education, food security, and the pandemic. It should be considered essential. What do you see as the great challenges our legislature should focus on now? Let us know at 277-5866 or email us at letstalk@kunm.org, or you can tweet to us at #letstalknm. Now, we're going to switch gears to another topic that deserves an entire hour of discussion, but we'll look for a quick overview today. We have Melissa Ontiveros, Executive Director of the New Mexico Public Health Association, with us to discuss some priority issues. Thanks for joining us today. Are you there?
I'm here. Hi. Thank you for having me today.
Absolutely. Good morning to you. First, I'd just like to emphasize the scale of public health work. It's much more than access to health care. Practitioners in public health often talk about social determinants of health. I think maybe if you could explain that concept a little bit, it would really illustrate to listeners how big public health work is.
Sure. Yeah. Like you said, public health is much more than just medical, but it's the conditions in which people are born, grow, live, work, and age. These conditions include intangible factors such as political, social, economic, and cultural structures. But in addition to those, it includes where people are lived, where they live, accessible healthcare, education, environment, neighborhoods, and access to healthy food. For example, can I give you an example?
Sure.
You have somebody a community with poor health or a lack of education. Well, that lack of education or poor health can impact employment opportunities because those people, they can't apply for a job because they're sick or they don't have the means to apply. Maybe they don't have broadband. Maybe they don't have computers. And in turn, that promotes unhealthy coping mechanisms such as substance abuse or overeating, unhealthy foods. And then that results in obesity, heart disease, diabetes, and depression. So social determinants of health, especially poverty, structural racism, and discrimination, create like stratification that are responsible for health inequities.
So
that's kind of what social determinants of health is.
I feel like it's almost then not too much of an exaggeration to say that public health is everything.
It sure is. So, I was talking to somebody yesterday and I was saying it's like a systemic umbrella that includes networks of people and organizations in private and public sectors that work together collaboratively to create the conditions in which people are healthy. That's kind of how I'd like to define it.
That might help explain then some of the broad issues that the New Mexico Public Health Association is interested in. Governor Lujan Grisham released her legislative priorities last week, as did the New Mexico Public Health Association. By the way, links to those lists are available on our website, kunm.org. One of the first that stands out is something the NMPHA is calling Respect New Mexico Women and Families. Now, that's aiming to repeal repeal a 50-ish-year-old abortion law, right? Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, sure. So abortion is one of the most common medical procedures for women. An estimated 1 in 3 women will have an abortion. So what we want to do is create access and complete contraceptive equity and as a human right and social justice. So we want to address those barriers to access to sexual and reproductive services, including abortion and contraceptives. We want to have and make sure that we protect reproductive health care for everyone.
Okay, and this is an issue on the federal level, right? Why is it important right now?
Because it is an issue in the federal level. And so with the Supreme Court, we want to make sure that New Mexico is protected just because of the structure of the Supreme Court. It could be detrimental, and we want to protect New Mexicans from that ban.
So you're saying then if the Supreme Court should happen to make some sort of ruling, that would that would change access, maybe based on federal rules, the state rule changed and in place prior to that? Did I get it right?
We want to make sure that we have healthcare providers, policymakers that can improve that. We want to improve that ability of women from all ethnic, we want to have that ability to that all women in all ethnic and socioeconomic backgrounds make informed decisions. And so if we have that ability, then we make sure that everyone has equal accessibility, equal equity, they can make those informed decisions with all the tools that they need.
Okay. A totally different topic in the realm of public health. Broadband internet access is lacking in much of New Mexico. There's Senate Bill 93 that seeks to establish a state office of broadband access and expansion. Can you tell us more about that and why this is a public health issue?
Sure. So this is so important. I live in Las Cruces, New Mexico, but I also work with people that live in Sunland Park, Anthony, Silver City. And what we're seeing is that a lot of people do not have access to broadband. One national survey estimated that 1 in 4 Americans do not have broadband internet access or devices needed to engage in video visits. So, talking about an equity issue, we have children who need to go to school, right? And our students are going to school from home. Well, how are they going to class? How are they doing their homework if they don't have broadband? We have many, many adults who have been let go or laid off of work, and they need to apply for unemployment. If they don't have access to broadband or connectivity, how are they applying for unemployment? How are they applying for jobs? So what we're calling broadband, it's much more than just broadband now or Wi-Fi. It is a utility. It is a social determinant of health.
And it hasn't been governed as a utility.
No, not yet, but hopefully it will.
Okay.
The
Public Health Association is encouraging another new tobacco tax. What are the details?
Sure. So we want to increase the tobacco tax by $2.
That's a lot.
And so it is a lot. But other states have done it too. And there's been many studies to increasing tobacco tax. And so people say, you're decreasing or increasing tobacco tax, and is that fair for people of low income communities? However, I was researching a little bit, and it seems to be that studies show that people that live in low income or lowest social economic status will reduce tobacco use with the increase of tobacco tax.
Okay, maybe that's the reason then for such a big tax hike. It's pretty bold. I think the last one was, last time they did this, it was less than a quarter, right? 18 cents or something like that.
35 cents last year, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think I've also heard that if people don't start smoking before the age of 18, they're typically not going to or something like that.
Yep. You're right. So people that smoke before the age of, smoke before the age of 18 will smoke when they become adults too. So Yeah.
So then I wonder if adding $2 to the price of a pack is kind of maybe also aimed at targeting younger folks who might not have as much money, and maybe it'll make a bigger difference to them.
Absolutely. So there was another study that showed that increasing tobacco tax for increasing tobacco tax, youth will decline, you know, they would not smoke or use tobacco products. Or they decrease use of tobacco products, let's just say.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us today. That is Melissa Ontiveros, Executive Director of the New Mexico Public Health Association. I wish we had more time to talk today, but we'll try to get you on again on a show in the future. We are going to pivot now to energy and the environment. But the pandemic first, the pandemic has lawmakers zooming to the legislative session this year. How should they plan for future emergencies so that we're able to respond better next time? Call 277-5866 or email us at letstalk@kunm.org and tell us what you think. All right, we'll now turn to reporter Kendra Chamberlain from New Mexico Political Report on the phone with us to fill us in on some of the energy and environmental bills we're likely to see movement on. Thanks for joining us this morning. Kendra, are you there?
Hi, Kavi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, first one of the big ones, the 2019 Energy Transition Act seeks to move utility companies away from coal and toward renewable energy gradually over the next couple decades. There are two follow-up bills this year that you've been looking at. What's going on there?
Yeah, so let's look at the first bill, which has been introduced by Democratic Senators Liz Stefanik, Bill Talman. And that would tweak a provision of the ETA, the authors say, in order to reinstate the Public Regulation Commission's ability to regulate PNM rate increases related to their plant abandonment costs. So under the ETA, a utility, for example, like PNM, can recover some of the sunk costs or undepreciated assets of their coal facilities as they exit those facilities early. And the funding mechanism that allows PNM to do that is called securitization. And so there are some readings of the ETA, particularly by Mariana Nancy of New Energy Economy. She's sort of been the main voice of criticism on this very specific provision of the ETA, which essentially doesn't allow the PRC to disapprove of a rate increase related to an abandonment cost. And so this bill would reinstate that authority. This legislation is really fascinating because PNM is currently going through an abandonment filing for its last coal plant, the Four Corners Power Plant, which it now hopes to exit by the end of 2024. So this could have big implications moving forward for PNM customers. The second bill has been introduced by Democratic Senator from Las Cruces, Bill Sewells, which would actually expand the securitization provision of the ETA to enable more utilities to use that funding mechanism as they close down their fossil fuel generation facilities. So that would include, for example, gas plants, which currently are not allowed to use securitization to do that.
Okay, this is a deep topic, and I'm not sure where to dig in, but we do also need to take a quick break. Let's just get it out of the way. You're listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Kaveh Movahed. Stay there. We'll be back in a minute.
Conrad Tao wrote this when he was 15 years old. It's called Eventide, inspired by the gentle arrival of night. Now, a dozen years later, it's still a favorite for Conrad Tao. We'll hear him and friends in concert playing Eventide on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
The clock is now ticking to hand over land in Arizona that is sacred to Apaches and other tribes to a mining company. The action was sealed in the final days of the Trump administration. We'll get an update on continuing efforts to protect the land known as Oak Flat. That's on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. We've covered a lot already this morning, and there's still time to call. Do you think legislators are able to act on multiple issues this session, or should they focus on the pandemic? Call 277-5866 and let us know what you think. All right, now let's take a call from Bob in Abiquiu. Bob, are you there?
I am.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I worked at Los Alamos from 1979 to 1991 on a project called Laser Fusion. And by 1991, we had reached a break-even point where we got as much energy out as we put in. That was a milestone. A month later, the entire project was canned, mothballed, they call it, which means it was cannibalized and never coming back. And all laser fusion funding was cut at Los Alamos, and there's no kind of research in that realm in New Mexico now. Also, New Mexico sits on a lot of hot magma, which could be used for geothermal production. And I'm wondering why politicians are bragging about 40% of their income for the run of the state comes from petroleum. I was under the assumption that burning fossil fuels was bad for the environment. So I'm a little upset about that.
Okay, great points, Bob. We have reporter Kendra Chamberlain from New Mexico Political Report. She's an environmental reporter, and she works on energy, too. Kendra, I wonder, have you heard anything about geothermal energy?
You know, I haven't. And I think that that caller brings up a great point. There are, you know, a lot of different types of kind of more creative, I guess, options for generating energy that, you know, research is sort of, you know, the markets for those are still kind of nascent. But it's going to be very exciting to see, you know, how those develop. Obviously, solar and wind has been the main focus because they're the most established and mature technologies that we have. But it's I had no idea that we were under so much magma that could be used for geothermal. So that's definitely an interesting idea.
Okay, well, the current reality is that we're relying a lot on fracking in many parts of the states. Some proposed changes this year to the 2019 Produced Water Act will tackle both energy and environment. What is produced water, and what are lawmakers seeking to do with the changes?
Yeah, so produced water is sort of a term that applies broadly to any sort of water that has been pulled up through the extraction, I should say, of oil. So here in New Mexico, a lot of our produced water is called formation water. There's sort of vast seas of very saline water underneath the ground here, and so that comes up with the oil when oil and gas operators are drilling. And you know, with the advent of fracking, the chemical the chemicals in the produced water have changed, but they're also, it's much more toxic now. And we have, you know, we're literally generating 4 to 7 barrels of produced water for every single barrel of oil. So we're just generating tons of this very highly toxic fluid. And so this year, Senator Cedillo Lopez has introduced a bill that would sort of tweak some of the provisions of the Produced Water Act of 2019 to a better track what's going on with that water, where it's being used and how it's being disposed, and then also to penalize operators for spills. The impetus for this was early in 2020, there was a big produced water pipe explosion that drenched a family home with this wastewater fluid. And I think, you know, a lot of people were really shocked to realize that under state law, you know, because it was an unintentional release, there was no penalty for the operator. So this bill would allow regulators to impose fines on operators for produced water spills and other types of oil and gas spills. And it would also prohibit, or I should say limit, the use of fresh water in the oil field because produced water can be recycled to some extent and just reused over and over again for drilling.
Okay, we have another caller, Dr. Elizabeth Berkey. My understanding is she wants to talk about how to retire some of the old oil and gas wells. Dr. Berkey, are you there?
Yes, I am. I've been increasingly concerned about the number of defunct oil, gas, and other abandoned mining projects, and was wondering if this is of capping those or sealing them is a state issue. Can it be a federal issue as well? Does it have to stick to local municipalities? And the difference between private and public lands that have these defunct wells and emission issuing pipes on their property.
Okay, that's, I think, probably a big issue and a big question. Kendra, do you have any input on that?
So this is definitely a very big issue that's sort of looming ahead for the state. I do believe, to the question of authority, you know, a lot of, here in New Mexico, a lot of the oil and gas activity does occur on federal public lands, BLM, for example. And so in that sense, it is a federal issue. But we also have, of course, abandoned mine or, you know, unused wells on state land and private land. So it is both. I think that, you know, the state, from what I understand in the reporting that I've done, the state is working with BLM to sort of address this issue. One of the concerns, though, that I have is that there doesn't really seem to be agreement on how many abandoned wells there are in the state. And so, you know, cleanup costs or just, you know, reclamation is challenging when you're not even sure how many of the wells you need to reclaim. So this is going to be a big issue. And in fact, you know, our oil conservation division director, Adrian Sandoval, testified in front of Congress, I think it was last year, about the need for a federal program to help states like New Mexico financially kind of deal with these astronomical costs of plugging the wells that aren't being used. And, you know, reclaiming them and not letting them just sit there. So this is a huge issue for the state moving forward.
Okay. You know, there is so much more to talk about when it comes to energy and environment. But Kendra, I know you need to run. So thank you so much for being with us. That's Kendra Chamberlain, environment and energy reporter from New Mexico Political Report. Maybe you feel differently about politics this year. Some people have tuned out while others are more engaged than ever. What should New Mexicans pay attention to? Give us a call at 277-5866 or tweet to us using the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. Our final guest today is reporter Andy Lyman from New Mexico Political Report and co-host, along with our own Megan Kamrick, of the podcast Growing Forward, which examines the cannabis industry in New Mexico. You can find links on KUNM.org. Good morning, Andy. Thanks for being here.
Hey, good morning, Kaveh.
All right. It feels like for the last several years, people have been saying this is the year that the legislature will get behind legalizing recreational cannabis. It's been fully legal in Colorado for several years, California too, but now also in Oregon and Washington, Nevada, Montana, South Dakota, and even Arizona now. Those are just the western states too. Have any recreational marijuana bills been filed yet this year?
No, none have been officially filed, but I've been speaking with lawmakers who plan to introduce them. We kind of also have the luxury to go back and look at previous bills. I think it's largely going to be similar to what has been introduced before, with some sort of fine tweaks here and there.
So then analysts, you know, say New Mexico needs to diversify its revenue streams. I wonder, you know, one of the big arguments for recreational cannabis is the increase in possible tax revenues. What are estimates that we've seen that could come along with legalization?
I think the last I've heard from some economists is possibly, you know, $100 million annually once things sort of even out. I think there's an expectation that the first year, if we legalize cannabis, that it'll sort of skyrocket. But my understanding is that the experts say it should even out to about, like I said, annually about $100 million a year.
And I guess that's just an estimate because a lot of it depends, right, on the structure of, you know, where government is involved and how it's distributed, dispensaries and so forth.
Yeah, I think it really hinges on what sort of tax structure we decide to use. I will say that there's going to probably be some debates about where to put that money if we legalize it. But the bottom line is that, yes, that, you know, there's sort of a sweet spot that, again, economic experts say hovers around, I think, between 16 and 20% tax. Any lower than that, you know, you're not going to see the full revenue. Any higher than that, I think there's folks that are concerned that would turn folks to the black market or illicit market, gray market, whatever you want to call it. In other words, if it's too expensive to buy at a legal store, then a lot of people, the expectation is that a lot of people would find other ways to buy it, cheaper ways to buy it.
Okay, so the ongoing debate about how the program will run in New Mexico. It's nothing new. In 2017, there was a Senate bill that failed that had the state running dispensaries, maybe not unlike liquor stores in other states. What was the problem with that?
I think it just made a lot of folks sort of uncomfortable. And when I say folks, I mean other lawmakers. It was a Republican effort in 2019. We haven't really seen a lot of movement on that sort of recommendation or that approach, I should say. But I think it makes folks a little leery because it does put sort of a certain liability on the state, right? There's a lot of things that go into that. It's still federally illegal at this point. So there's questions of, does the state want to be involved in sort of overseeing that? I don't know much about, the bad and good of state-run liquor stores, but I think just overall it was just sort of dismissed. And actually there were some Democrats that voted against that bill that was combined with a Democratic bill. And so it kind of turned some folks off. And so I guess I wouldn't be all that surprised if it comes up again, but I think it's sort of folks have moved on from that.
Okay. And I guess there are just a lot of politics at play too, right? I believe, isn't it true that one of the big players in the industry, in the marijuana industry in New Mexico and Arizona, is represented legally by some state legislators?
Yes. So there is, I believe what you're referencing is Ultra Health. It's a company that does business in New Mexico. I believe their office is based in Arizona, or they have a office in Arizona. But I guess what I'm getting at is, to my understanding, they don't operate out of Arizona. But yes, their legal counsel is a state senator, Senator Jacob Candelaria. I actually addressed that in one of my stories recently, and it sort of, I guess, brings up another issue of probably citizen legislature or folks that don't get a paycheck, they get a stipend to represent their district. It's an issue that comes up in all sorts of ways in the legislature is, what should we allow lawmakers to do outside of the legislature? And at this point, there's not much we can do. They all have day jobs and many of them are lawyers. And I would also point out that Jacob Candelaria, Senator Candelaria, is also a patient himself. So there might be an argument there that he's, got a personal interest just beyond whatever. I should be clear. He has stated over and over again that he doesn't have a financial interest necessarily in legalization. That's an issue that comes up with all sorts of topics.
This is maybe the perfect time to read an email from George. He says that the legislature is just a vehicle for lobbyists to bleed the taxpayers. When are they actually going to do something for working people? He says the state's unemployment laws need immediate and radical reform. Somewhat related. Okay. With legalization, would there be a need for a state medical marijuana program?
I think most people would, in the community industry, whatever you want to call it, would argue absolutely yes. There's a couple of reasons here is that folks that rely on cannabis as a form of medication, don't want to pay the higher prices that generally, they don't want to pay that 20% tax. And so I think in any proposal that comes forward, or most any, is going to have a medical protection provision in it, meaning that, we can keep lower prices for patients, maybe even tax-free. Right now prescription, that's a whole nother issue we could probably talk longer about, but right now prescription drugs are exempt from gross receipts taxes, which most of us consider sort of a sales tax. But right now there's sort of a battle, if you will, between the state and some producers. I think it's pending at the state Supreme Court right now whether medical cannabis should be taxed at all. The argument from the state is that it's not a prescription because it's a recommendation from doctors. I would expect that this, at least in conversation, will come up as far as, what to tax and what not to tax.
And then we've also heard an argument about protecting the medical supply chain too, right?
We've seen in other states. I think most recently Illinois was the one I saw a lot of news coverage on. Was, you know, within the first day of legalization, people were lined up and it was depleting just any stock. And to be clear, there's not really a substantive difference between medical cannabis and recreational cannabis. It comes down to stuff like taxes and how easily it is to be purchased. And of course, medical cannabis patients don't have to be 18 or 21. So there's an age difference thing there. So there's it's not really that the actual product is any different. But yeah, there's concern amongst patients here and patient advocates that if we don't sort of bolster the number of plants that people are allowed to grow, producers, I should say, that we might see a shortage for patients.
Okay, finally, certainly it's fair to consider the potential for substance abuse, but I wonder about crime. Do opponents point to increased crime or black market activity? You know, what kind of evidence are we seeing in other states?
You know, I think one of the issues I come across in this is that, and this goes with sort of psychiatric studies, crime studies, is we get sort of sometimes conflicting reports. You know, there's some reports that show, you know, impaired driving go down. Other reports show that it goes up. I think that there's probably some digging into those things to try to figure out why they're different. But overall, I mean, I think one of the arguments for legalization is that, you know, that officers, law enforcement officers, have time to sort of pursue some of those other things besides just mere possession, right? I will also point out, this is an interesting point that people seem to miss sometimes, is while we don't have a test directly to find impairment for cannabis, you know, it's not the same as alcohol. You can't do a breathalyzer test, so to speak. But we also, you know, to keep in mind, we also have roadside tests for impairment of any kind, right? We also don't have breathalyzers for Oxycontin or opiates or any sort of prescription drug that might be able to impair your driving. So I think some of those things, and we can look to other states that I don't know that it's as big of a concern as some folks say. That it is a concern. Obviously, we don't want people driving impaired, especially given that our state has sort of a problem with that. But yeah, I think that there's answers to those issues.
And that brings up another thought then. If we are going to legalize marijuana and cannabis, what happens to all the people who have records for drug-related offenses or are in jail? Is there talk of expungement or anything like that?
Yeah, that's a really great point. And yes, the folks I've spoken with that plan on sponsoring these types of bills, and even Senate Majority Leader Peter Wirth, they sort of put that as a priority. I think that's going to be sort of a deal breaker. I think the expungements is sort of a given. I think anybody that's pushing for this agrees that we have to make sure that we can address these criminal records under previous laws. The question then becomes, do we make it an automatic expungement? Right now, the state does have an expungement law, just generally speaking, but it does put the sort of onus on the convicted to go sort of file a petition. And so the real debate over expungement and legalization is going to be whether we make this an automatic process where people just have their records cleared, or do they have to, you know, go get a lawyer and file a petition? And again, that's another deal breaker for, I know at least Senator Daniel Ivysoto, you know, he says absolutely we shouldn't make these people go through the ringer to get their records expunged.
All right. Thank you, Andy. That's Andy Lyman from New Mexico Political Report and co-host with Megan Kamrick of the podcast Growing Forward. Our time is up today. It went too fast. Thanks everyone who called in to share your thoughts. And thanks so much to our guests, David Abbey, G. Andres Romero, Melissa Ontiveros, Kendra Chamberlain, and Andy Lyman. This is a big topic and we couldn't do it all in an hour, but we will be covering more of the legislative session in future episodes. Until then, please keep sharing your thoughts on Twitter, hashtag Let's Talk NM. On Facebook, search for KUNM Radio, or email us, letstalk@kunm.org. If you missed part of the show, stream it online or subscribe to our podcast. You can find it wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Our engineer is not Marino Spencer today. Sorry, is Roman Garcia. Megan Kamrick handled the phones. Taylor Velasquez live tweeted the show. And Ty Bannerman is our producer. I'm Kaveh Movahed. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.